The Tiny Podcast is a Better Manchester initiative. Visit www.bettermanchester.com/subscribe to learn more. When you subscribe to Better Manchester, you'll have full access to captivating featured stories, uplifting ideas, and helpful community updates. We hope you subscribe and join us in this next evolution of #BetterManchester. Connect on any device at any time to Better Manchester today. Better Manchester, connecting communities. Mighty things from small beginnings grow. John Dryden, England's first poet laureate, which is not only a position, but also a responsibility. A responsibility to encourage their communities to expand thoughts. A responsibility to question their surroundings and search for a deeper meaning. A responsibility to educate new minds and help grow seasoned ones. Today, I have the pleasure of talking to Ryan Parker. A son, brother, husband, father, educator, activist, but also the town of Manchester's very own poet laureate. I'm your host, Ryan Ward, and welcome to the Tiny Podcast.
Before we dive into what a poet laureate exactly is, because that's something that I do want to talk about eventually, I'm interested because now that I work for the town of Manchester, I've been working here for 2 years, and I didn't even know that existed. I'm just like, what does that even mean? What is that? What's up with that? And I really love a lot of the things that you sent in the document, you know, before we had the interview. I was really blown away by, like, just the amount of things that you do, and not just, you know, outside of the poet laureate, and, like, just the things that you're trying to accomplish, or the things that, like, you know, especially within the education system. You had mentioned that you have 20 years of teaching experience and that you've gained a lot of traction within, you know, yourself and, like, teaching other educators and trying to break other educators out of that proverbial box, in my own words, trying to, you know, expand what education might look like or might mean. So how do you encourage others, and what change do you see needed within that?
I think that the best way to encourage others, if you're speaking about it specifically in correlation with what you just mentioned in terms of education and what I'm really passionate about, is just this reimagination of what it should look, sound, and feel like outside of the realm of where it comes from. I think that, you know, the way to encourage others is to be in it, to be a model of that work. And I forget the second half of your question, but I think that it has to do with maybe what's missing, or what I'm finding that's missing, is the personal work. So the personal work of, like, really reflecting, specifically as this applies to education, and it can apply to other things as well, but the personal work of being really honest about, all right, what is my lived experience? How have I been socialized and conditioned to think and believe certain things about the world, about people? And how can I interrogate that, knowing that my beliefs actually influence what it is that I do?
Yeah.
And so in the world of education, it's like we so often jump into the operational component of, like,
how does it work?
This is what we do technically. This is, like, here's the curriculum. Here are the rules and but what is informing any kind of system that's in place are the people that are in part of the system. And so if the people aren't doing the personal work to really reflect on their racial bias, their cultural bias, what their experience was as students, and how they're taught to believe what education should look, sound, and feel like, then they continue to perpetuate something that hasn't been working.
Right.
While I'm an educator, at the same time, I'm a big critic of the education system at large, and I believe that race needs to be centered and all of that.
Yeah.
I know that historically the school was designed by people who don't look like me and for people who don't look like me. That's just historical fact.
Systemic, yeah.
Right,
yeah.
And so we still operate off of agrarian school schedule. You know, your grandparents went to school 5 days a week, had Saturdays and Sundays. It's all based on the agrarian school schedule, and we don't farm like that anymore, yet we still stick. That's just one example of where we still stick to an old system that is harmful. We have curriculum that is not centering Black and brown folks in ways that they should be.
Yeah.
And then we have folks that are complaining about critical race theory being the monster that's, like, chewing everything up when really it's been the missing piece, which is the personal work and having real honest, courageous conversations about who it is that we are, what we've been taught to believe, and how can we like begin to change that a bit so that we are making sure we're meeting the needs of everybody that shows up in these teaching and learning
equity,
spaces.
Equity, exactly. Yeah, 100%. Yeah. We did some training within Manchester for, you know, the counselors, and I'm a pavilion coordinator, but I'm also ambassador. And we took a class on that, and, you know, what can we do to bring people to the table? What can we do to keep people at the table? And who are we missing from the table? You know, that whole idea of looking wider than what, you know, who not looking at who's here, but who's not here? Who's not getting food? Who's not getting, like, the need, you know, food in this case being the education, being, like, the information that can, you know, putting it out the right way, putting it in a way that's digestible. Like, you know, who's not getting that need yet? And I think that as you pointed out, like it's a system that has not been maybe, you know, reevaluated in that grand of a scale. And it's scary. Mm-hmm. I think it can be scary to think about that. So, you know, but at the same time, I think it's just, you know, it needs to be looked at again.
It can be scary to look at it, and it is uncomfortable for folks to look at it, particularly white folks.
Yeah.
But it's even more scary and more uncomfortable when you continue to perpetuate a legacy of oppression. The results are harmful for everybody. White people, black people, brown people.
It breeds more harmful to everyone.
So we have to reexamine it. So that missing piece, I would say, is that personal work that needs to be done in order to impact how we engage interpersonally, which then will change the operation in a way that it's equitable.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think, you know, when I think of my education and, like, the teachers that I had, it was the teachers who met me on a personal level, who didn't see me as a student. They saw me as a person.
Yes,
and they saw me as a person who was going through struggles.
Yes.
They saw me as somebody,
right.
You know, I'll give a shout out to Mr. Marino. He was a psychology teacher, and he, you know, he was like, Maslow's hierarchy of needs, you know, if you're tired, sleep. If you need to get food, go to the cafe and get some food, come back to class. Nobody took advantage of this system because he let us. He gave us the opportunity to take advantage of it, to be like, oh, I'm going to sleep in class. I'm going to go at lunch and just sit at lunch. And nobody did it because he met us and we wanted to learn.
Yeah.
We wanted to know what he had to say because he gave us respect and we gave it back.
At that foundational human level.
Interpersonal, like you said.
Yes, and I would add to that Maslow's hierarchy of need. Like, I would even bump it up a step because a lot of people don't know this. Maslow got all the credit for that hierarchy of needs concept, but it comes out of Blackfoot indigenous folks' way of thinking. They have their hierarchy of needs, but the difference is that it's less individualistic. It's more community-based. So now I'm not telling you, hey, you're hungry, go get something to eat. Hey, go rest. I'm saying, hey, I'm providing this space for you to rest, and I'm providing you this food as your community member.
Yeah, I love that.
As an extra,
it was Blackfoot, you said?
Blackfoot Nation. Yeah.
Wow, that's what's not being taught. This is what's not being taught.
Right.
This is why I'm so glad. I appreciate you a lot. So another thing that you brought up was your passion for teaching young people about race equity, as we brought up before, and the parallels of power that, like, poetry and hip hop bring as well. What would you say was your biggest challenge within the realm of education?
The biggest challenge in the realm of education. Oh my God. Okay, so, like, we've covered a lot of it, honestly.
Right.
The biggest challenge is folks continuing, especially folks that are in power in this institution of education, continuing to function in a way that goes against the grain of humanity. And so the biggest personal challenge, like, I feel like I've been able to be effective in my teaching and learning spaces, and there's no document that I could show you as a credential to like prove to you that I've been effective. However, the stories that my students and those communities tell about me are my credentials, and so those are the most important. Those are the most important stories. So it's hard. That can't happen in an isolated space. So for me, I would say the most difficult thing is, of course, mindset. For educators in particular, doing that personal work and then sustaining it within a system that's designed to not operate that way. It's not designed, like, I don't know if you know this, but, you know, state testing drives curriculum.
Yeah, okay.
So,
yeah.
As opposed to the needs of human beings
humans
becoming, right?
Right.
So for me, that's a very difficult component
in
the world of education. That's probably one of my biggest
struggles. Just the standardization of, you know, what education is when it's not
knowing that it knowing where it came from, yeah, right? And knowing where it needs to go. It's tough being in that space. Contribute to it at the same time. Fight against it while you're in it. You know what I mean?
So 100%.
That's the struggle.
So okay, then what is an example to flip it? What's an example of where you see positive change and growth within that system?
Yo, I can really speak specifically to my particular community in Manchester.
That's fantastic.
And I think that one of the biggest things that we can celebrate in the midst of this struggle that we're engaging in is the fact that we're engaging in it in Manchester.
Yeah.
And that we are beyond, I think that we are beyond a cosmetic kind of equity or checkity.
Yeah. Oh, Joe.
Our gains are expressed in the fact that people, educators, and those in power here in this district, from superintendent to administrators, are actually having these courageous conversations. Now, we have a long way to go.
Right, yeah.
But we actually are engaging in the difficult, courageous conversations around race that we need to be engaging in order to impact our operation. Now, there is tons more that needs to be done, but you're asking me to lift up what's positive. Yeah, yeah. I think that's positive. I want to shout out Rhonda Filbert, and I want to shout out Dr. Kearney, who are two mentors of mine, but also my colleagues. We have a race and equity department in Manchester.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
And it's fantastic because it actually is, because they're actually dope. The department is dope and is very much committed to and engaged in the work. I can tell you that it's not like a surface level. There's a lot of, you know, 2020 happened.
Yeah.
And a lot of folks is like, oh, now we got DEI and we got an equity position here and equity position here. It's not one of these pop-ups. We have to do it to check off a box.
Right, right.
It's the real deal.
It's the real deal.
And that's positive to me. That we have that department, but more importantly, that we have folks like Narun and Felicia and Lisette and Rhonda and Dr. Kearney, and even outside influences like Calvin Terrell. And I'm lucky that I get to be working with them. We have Jason Fredland as well. We have a team of folks that's committed to this work, Tracy Gallivan. So, yeah, that's positive fantastic. To me. We're having these conversations. We're shaking things up. We're shaking things up.
And it needs to be
in a way that
up.
Needs to be. It needs 100%. To happen.
It just it's.
And there's tons of work to do, but But we're doing it. It's incremental.
It's something. It's not nothing anymore.
Right.
It's not just talking about it. It's actually doing. And that's I think, you know, actions speak louder than words. This is action. This is actionable, documentable, provable things that are happening. And I think that I love that. I'd love to learn more about that, maybe offline, because I think that's something I didn't know about. And when reading through your bio, that was just that's amazing. Let's get into my next question. I'm also curious.
Yo, hold up. It just hit me. I forgot to tell you. Yo, have you heard of, in our district, we have race and equity read alouds. So it's part of the curriculum. So K-4, I was a proponent. And shout out to Krista. We wrote curriculum. Now I'm working with Felicia to bring it 5-8 and eventually to 12. So these read alouds are books that are authored by Black and Brown authors. And the stories are centered on Black and Brown characters, and it speaks to their excellence and their beauty and brilliance and joy.
That's amazing.
And also struggles that are very real because of the racial context. But what this does, I can't believe I didn't mention
this. This is great. We're going to talk about it. I got this.
Yo, what this does is it creates windows for our white babies to be able to look in and see the lived experiences of those who may not look like them or have the same religious or cultural backgrounds as them. And not only just our white babies to see windows, because we also have our Black and Brown babies who are also looking at people who might be different from them too. Like, we're not a monolith, right? It's windows in that way as well, but it also offers mirrors for our Black and Brown students who often don't see themselves represented as central characters who are just full of so much brilliance and beauty and joy. And yes, the struggles are real too, and that's a part of it, but it's not the only story.
Right.
And so these read alouds,
it's
sparking courageous conversations between the teachers and the students, and students are able to share their experiences. And so you asked me, what is something really positive that's happening? Yeah. Yo, I can't believe that I missed that one. That has to be one of the biggest ones, along with everything else I said.
That's fantastic. That's going to segue perfectly into one of my questions, and I'm so glad that you brought that up. You put out a book recently, right? Or a poet, some of your poetry work recently. And you had said in what you had written to me, let's see, you mentioned that your most recent book of collection of poems, they're centered on the necessary narrative of Black joy and excellence, as you just said again, that coexists with the trauma narrative that so often dominates the focus in relation to Black minds and bodies. That spoke tremendously to me. So I'm a veteran, and I feel like I've got my trauma, what I went through is very close to me. It's very something very personal to me. And I think a lot of the times I feel that people focus on that. People see, I tell people I'm a veteran, they go, oh, I'm so sorry. Thank you for everything. And it's like, and I'm just like, well, no, I'm also Ryan. I'm also, I'm also a musician. Like, I appreciate that. And that's the thing, is it's this balance of, it is a huge part of me. What I went through is a part of who I am, but it's not only what I want people to see. So that spoke to me a lot. So, but this isn't about myself. I actually wrote that. This isn't about myself. So can you elaborate on why we need both narratives? Why it's detrimental for that trauma focus, but it also important to hit both the joy and acknowledge the trauma. Like why that balance is important.
I mean, thank you for lifting that. I think that in your example that you provided with your own lived experience is spot on. I think that anytime, it's a detriment anytime we begin to view this world and people at large through a single story. Mm-hmm. And so for me, that's why it's most important to not only share the trauma that is true, like you said it yourself, right. It's not separate from your lived experience. Right. Because I didn't want to create something and be like, oh, be happy, just focus on joy, ignore the trauma. No, the trauma is there and it's living and breathing, and we have to learn from that too. But it's not the only single story of us.
Right.
And it's specifically dangerous when you attach that only to Black and brown bodies,
right,
and minds and spirits, because it blocks you from being able to see the exquisiteness and the brilliance and the beauty that Black and brown people are made of.
It's like tunnel vision. It's like tunnel vision. Yeah. It's creating a narrative that somebody writes based on
that
one
is
story.
That's not our only story.
No, absolutely.
And it's important specifically for the most marginalized people, BIPOC folks, especially all intersectionalities involved, for the most marginalized to also remember, like go back to remembering that, you know, you got greatness in your DNA. Like your story, like you originate from geniuses.
Yeah.
Like literally there's like pyramids still standing as evidence of it in Egypt, in Africa. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like you, that's a story that for them, especially, and we're talking about education.
Right.
Education has operated for a very long time through a very single lens.
Yeah, yeah.
I could tell, and I'm missing out on stories of my Asian brothers and sisters. I'm missing out on stories of my LGBTQIA+ brothers and sisters. I'm missing out on stories for my indigenous brothers and sisters. Yeah. I myself have, because I've come up through a system of education that has focused on a single story. It's important that we disrupt that.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's why we need to focus on that. Yes, there is a history of trauma and hardship and struggle and injustice.
And that matters.
Matters.
Yeah, but.
And so doesn't the beauty, the brilliance, the joy.
Absolutely.
The genius of Black and brown
people.
Yeah,
absolutely. That's the duality of life, I feel like, that like a lot of people miss. A lot of people get pigeonholed into these ideas that you know, and maybe it's because of generational trauma. Maybe it's years of, like, my family taught me this and that. But we go back to education, because, you know, where do people learn the most? You know, they learn a lot at home, which is important. But if teachers are perpetuating the ideas that are also being instilled at home, you know, if you get that different, if you take a kid, you know, who's being fed one thing at home, and then you go to school and you've got, you know, there's no moral ambiguity. It's just that, no, here are just the truth. Here's just what happened to people. Here's what
this is history.
This is history. Right. Just how it is. Like, right. You know, the, not this side story or that side story. Here's the entire story, you know. Mm-hmm. And obviously, yeah. And again, we talk about things are difficult, but the hardest things in life are the ones that are most worth doing sometimes. Mm-hmm. You know, the things that are hardest to change are the things that need to change the most, you
right,
know?
Right.
Even within ourselves, you know, like how, if you're stuck in that train of mm-hmm. thought, if you're stuck in a you know, an aggressor mindset, whatever it is, and you don't have to take that time to reflect, you don't look inward, and school can teach that. Mm-hmm. We can teach other people to look differently. To don't look just like this,
right.
Look like this.
And to know? Look at yourself.
Yeah,
and
open your eyes.
Reflect on your person, like, open your eyes, think about, all right, what was my upbringing? You know, how what was my lived experience? What was I taught to believe? How does the world really show up? Where have I, like, been limited in my thought? And, oh, how can I, like, engage in some of the personal work of learning more
yeah.
about what's outside of what I've been socialized to just believe so that I can engage interpersonally in ways that are effective and the operation ends up being what it needs
yeah,
to be.
Yeah, absolutely. That's amazing. So do you think that when you were younger, is this what you thought you'd be doing? Did you think that you were going to become a poet laureate or that you were going to, you know, be this like this beacon of creativity and advocacy, or were you going in a different direction when you were younger? Was this kind of, you know, speak a little bit on, you know, just on your past.
When I was young, like, there's no way that I could speak right now and be like, yo, when I was a kid, it was my dream to grow up and be a poet laureate, you know? Not. And I don't know about the beacon thing, but I know that I definitely swim and enjoy creativity and art and tangling words and messing around with linguistics and expression of self. I best process the world through poems.
Yeah.
And I don't even know if it's not even necessarily a want. It's like a need for me personally. So growing up, yo, I wanted to be a Care Bear. Like, I used to watch the Care Bears.
Yeah.
With my cousins, Sonia and Mandy, and they had, like, Sunshine Bear.
Yo.
And I was like, yo, when I grow up, I'm going to be a Care Bear.
Did
you
know what you'd have on your stomach? Did you already have it down?
I didn't know. It was like a peace symbol.
That's
you know
still
what I
good.
Mean?
That's still good.
And I wanted to be an NBA basketball player, you
yeah.
know, of course, and a rapper. And I ended up being two of the things that I wanted to be. I'm a Care Bear. You know, that's
yeah.
what I do. Literally, that's
yeah.
my work. As
yeah.
I, you know, I'm a Care Bear. I grew up to be this big Care Bear. And I rap, and rap is poetry. And as laureate, one of my big things is, like, we talked about a lot about education, but as laureate, one of my goals was to get folks to reimagine what poetry looks, sounds, and feels like
yeah,
as well.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
To get out of the traditional zone, the only limited page poetry. It just sounds quiet
yeah.
like this, and the people quietly clap
yeah,
at me.
Yeah,
ABA, like,
ABA, yeah,
like,
yeah.
Yeah, wanted to change a Shakespearean sonnet. Like, what people's perspectives were just around poetry itself, that hip-hop is actually one of the greatest forms of poetry in existence.
Oh my God,
you know?
Yes.
And so, back to the question, no, I didn't. I didn't. I wasn't like, yeah, I'm going to aspire to be a poet laureate.
I kind of set you up for that one.
Yeah. I'm just honored. So I just operate off a passion for wanting to play with words. I like to do poems and wake poems up in other people.
Yeah.
And I give all, and I forgot to do this, you know, all gratitude to the ancestors who paved the path so
mm.
I may arrive mm. right now in this moment with this interview before you, you know, and I know I'm responsible for continuing to pave that path for those that will one day be an ancestor too. And I give thanks to the indigenous folks, and here in Manchester, it's a Podunk tribe specifically,
mm.
who are the originator curators of this ground,
mm.
because I wouldn't be having this conversation with you if it weren't for them.
Absolutely.
You know, and I give thanks to you for inviting me in and finding me worthy to interview.
Oh, of course.
And I give thanks to, you know, shout out to Julia Paul. She was the last Manchester Poet Laureate.
Yeah.
I was going to wake up and do poems. Anyways, I'm passionate
yeah,
about that.
Yeah,
anyways,
yeah.
Other folks heard some of those poems or watched me run a work or were in one of my workshops or at a performance, and they were inspired and touched in some way. And Julia was like, yo, I actually want to nominate you as Laureate. So it's not even, I can't even credit myself. Like, I'm going to do the poems anyways. Other folks saw it and found me worthy to fulfill this position. And
yeah.
so I try to do it the best of my ability.
Well,
and I love poetry.
I love what you just said, because I think you're right. Like, I'm very thankful for all this. Dude, that's something that I constantly tell myself, try to remind myself, just, you know, especially with things, you know, life is tough. Everything, you know, everything is hard in life.
Yeah.
There's, you know, everything's difficult. But, like, remembering, just having that humbleness around life and just being like, other people paved the way for me to have this. We got a roof.
Right.
We've got lights. You know, we've got electricity.
Yeah.
And people built this. Yeah. People, you know, and like and indigenous people.
Yes.
Built
gratitude.
This, you know, it's remembering where this came from. Where like you said, the ground we came from. I think that's just absolutely beautiful. I think that's something that I encourage other people, other listeners, to think more about in their daily life. Just
Absolutely. Let's go back and remember.
Absolutely. Yeah. I couldn't agree more. All right. So, Parker, I want to thank you again, for real. Just bringing your energy and light today. It's just been really, this has been a really eye-opening conversation. I hope a lot of people learn from this. I hope that people take the time to listen to your words. I hope people take the time to look into the various things that you spoke about, you know, with the equity, race and equity in Manchester. I think that that's an amazing thing that, you know, I want to learn more about. And the morning readings as well. Like, that's something beautiful that I had not known about. So I hope other people, you know, are learning from this and are getting more from this than just, you know, a good conversation. But what really you were speaking about, and what, you know, the words that really came out, because I think your words are powerful. Like, it was very clear. Like,
oh,
you know, just from
so
our,
kind.
No, seriously. I really appreciated this. It was an amazing. I'm glad this was the first episode of the podcast, the first interview.
I didn't know it was the first one. So
That's it. So for anybody listening as well, if you want more information on Ryan Parker, you can follow him on Instagram at Peace Love Parker, all one word. You know, give him a follow, check out his music, check out his poetry, see what he's doing, because he is doing, and we need more doers right now. So make sure that you follow an example, or at the very least, just listen, open up your ears a little bit, because I think that we'd all be a little better off having some more Parker energy around, honestly.
Oh,
so
kind. Appreciate that.
Absolutely. So that's going to do it for us on the Tiny Podcast. Thank you again, Parker, for coming. You gave us some really great insights on a lot of that stuff. So I really do appreciate you being here.
Word. Much love. Much right. love. Thank you.
Thank you, man. I really appreciate
All right.
it.
The Tiny Podcast is a production of Better Manchester, an initiative of the Town of Manchester in collaboration with the Department of Leisure, Family, and Recreation. For more information on the Tiny Podcast, visit manchesterct.gov. Thanks for listening, and until next time, this is Ryan Ward signing off.